Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On April 22nd, WOSU will air Chefs in the City. It's a culinary event that spotlights local celebrity chefs and restaurants in Central Ohio. And the theme this year is local foods and focuses on the growing commitment to sustainability. We invited three folks who are participating in this project in the Chefs in the City event to join us today to talk about that commitment and how the trend has broadened its scope, how it's changed over time in Central Ohio. Joining us today is Michael Jones. He's the owner of the Greener Grocer and the North Market, and he's also a board member and executive director of Local Matters. It's a nonprofit organization devoted to the virtues of locally grown food. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Also with us is Adam Weller. He's owner, farmer of the Wayward Seed Farm, a business committed to total transparency between the consumer and the food he consumes. Adam sells his food in the North Market, Worthington Farmers Market, Clintonville Community Market, and at the Whole Foods Market. Welcome to the show today. You're a busy guy.
Thanks, Ann.
I guess you're all busy guys. With us also is Chef Kent Rigsby from Rigsby's Kitchen. He's an acclaimed Italian Mediterranean restaurant and longtime fixture in Columbus's Short North Arts District. Kent works regularly with local growers, and locally grown food drives his menus. Kent, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Good morning.
Let's start with Michael Jones. Your organization, Local Matters, started as something called the Greater Columbus Food Shed Project, and it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, and it's other things have changed besides the name over the years. It started out as a collaboration. How has the approach to changing the public's eating habits evolved over time?
Well, Local Matters, in its current form, was really built on two community projects, one of which was the Greater Columbus Food Shed Project. The other was the Central Ohio Chef Growers Network. I think both were really working on trying to connect people to local food in their own way. My colleagues and I at Local Matters now really are focused on, you know, how local food really can help transform the community and create a healthy community through the lens of food. So that's really based on our belief that food, and especially local food, really does connect us to the most important issues of our time. So it's things like connections to a healthy body, a healthy environment, a healthy economy. Those are all the kinds of things that we're working on right now through this lens of local food.
So a lot of us grew up with the old eat your vegetables kind of a thing. And a lot of us, you know, had gardens, or we learned about it when we were kids. But that's changed. When did it occur to you that this was a necessary objective?
Well, I am also a chef by trade, and I've always had an interest in food. I grew up on a farm, so I had that connection early on as well. I think I have noticed through the years from the perspective of a chef that more and more people don't cook anymore, don't really have a reference of where their food comes from. And in fact, one of the things that we ask people often is, you know, how much do you know about the food on your plate? And it's interesting the looks that we get from people when we ask that question, because we're pretty disconnected from our food, not only the source of our food, but I also think anything that's related to the skills that are needed to actually prepare food, preserve food, all those things that our grandparents used to do, many of us don't know how to do anymore.
Yeah, preserving food especially is a lost art. You've said that less than 1% of the food consumed in Ohio is grown in Ohio, and that increasing that amount to just 10% could mean that about 10% of the $42 billion spent in Ohio every year would stay here. That comes up to, you know, to $4.5 or $4.2 billion or something like that. Mm-hmm. Where do you get those kind of numbers from?
Well, the Ohio Department of Agriculture is the source for that information, and we're – Local Matters is certainly doing some work with them as well in terms of trying to create marketplace opportunities for local farmers, because I think if that number is really going to shift, there's going to have to be an increase in the amount of food that's actually grown in the state that you can eat, because even though Ohio is an agricultural state, a lot of what's grown here is commodity-type crops, things that you would feed animals. So what we're hoping to see is more and more food grown that people can actually eat.
Corn is king, but not as much of it is that really nice sweet yellow corn or white corn that we like so much in Ohio.
That is correct. Even though a lot of that commodity corn that's grown finds its way into many of the foods that we eat, and really I think is at the heart of some of the big issues that we're starting to see around food, especially things that relate to, you know, health issues like obesity and diabetes, especially among children.
So you've been doing this for quite a while and you've been interested in it. How have the obstacles changed over time, or are they basically the same thing?
Well, I think the fact that more and more people are aware of local food, the benefits of local food, or interested in finding out more about it, in many cases, you know, growing their own or becoming part of CSAs or finding retailers that sell local food, all of those things have done a lot to kind of move the needle in terms of seeing more local food out in our community. But there are still what I would call infrastructure barriers that we're going to have to overcome if this local food system is really going to grow to the place where we'd like to see it. You know, things like distribution opportunities that are more regionally based, or infrastructure opportunities where processing can take place of both produce and animals, for example. Those are still some big obstacles to, you know, growing this food system the way many of us would like to see it grow.
If you're just joining us, it's All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, and we're talking about local food and what it means to us and how it helps us help ourselves. My guests are Chef Kent Rigsby of Rigsby's Kitchen, also Michael Jones of Local Matters, and Adam Welly of the Wayward Sea Farm. Kent, I thought one of the coolest things I wrote about it at some point was the collaboration of restaurant owners in Central Ohio to start buying in together local food and locally grown food. How what's it like to be a restaurant owner and be committed to this kind of a thing?
It's an exciting time just because there is more interest and more availability, and a lot of farmers out there, they're trying to sell their food to nice restaurants and have the public take advantage of that. So it's been a sort of a new era for restaurants to have opportunity, but there are a lot of challenges, a lot of stumbling blocks, and part of it is the distribution that Michael talked about.
Well, talk about the distribution a little bit more, Adam. What are the challenges there?
Well, the challenges is that we have a lot of self-minded and self-interested farmers that are on a very small scale. So you have a lot of 2-acre operations. You have a lot of 5-acre operations. And there isn't really a net aggregate for food yet. Everybody's on their little island, and they're trying to find opportunities and marketplaces for their food. So we're trying to advocate long-term and short-term more of a kind of cooperative effort on the distribution end. Maybe we can start working together to get more organized, more kind of symbiotic, more coetition, so we can get food to people more regularly instead of essentially being a lot of small operators out there.
So how exactly does that work when you talk about all of that? Do you have an organization of growers out there?
Not yet.
Okay.
I have about
just a twinkle in your eye then right now.
I have about 5 people here locally in Central Ohio, and most of them are my friends. And we're starting to work together on production costs. We're working together on succession planning so we can consistently have a crop, something like baby carrots for restaurants, something that Kent could use consistently. We're trying to work out where we can have that consistently so that he can offer it on his menu for not just 2 weeks but for 3 months. And I think that would facilitate much more purchasing across the board from restaurants if we could accomplish that. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Well, the obstacle seems to be the very thing, though, that makes it all special, which is that human touch, that personal touch. You know, everybody has their own thing that they're into. You know, one of the problems with the industrialization of our food system, you know, for some people it's a problem, for other people it's not, but is the change in how many kinds of corn are available to us, and how many kinds of mushrooms, and how many kinds of baby carrots, and how many kinds of different what kind of variety we have. And when people do it individually, they bring that back.
Uh-huh.
So when you talk about baby carrots, Kent, and you need baby carrots for your restaurant, what do you do when they run out?
Well, the baby carrots aren't the most important thing. It's the seasonality of the food.
Okay.
And, you know, young sweet carrots in the spring are magnificent and they're wonderful. And we will use those as long as they're available. When they're not, we will use something else. And I think that, here in America, in certain ways, we've gotten spoiled with all the variety of food at our fingertips every day of the year. And I think that if you look back to our ancestors and to other examples in Europe and everything, people approach food in a different way. They do think about the seasonality of food. And I think that that's one of the goals that I have. And I know that, my cohorts here as well to really embrace that notion. And try, and it's ultimately about education and people getting educated about it, which Michael's so good about because he's starting in the schools and everything. So,
well, exciting. One thing about food is you have a potato, and I think we forget sometimes that there's other ways to use a potato besides baked potato and mashed potato, and it's how all the different varieties of ways. So when people have their squash coming in the summer and they're overwhelmed by it and they're dumping it off on my porch, mysteriously squash appears on my porch all summer long, that's because they don't know all the different ways to prepare it. And you were talking about that earlier, Michael, that they just don't know how to use the food.
Well, and one of the places where we're starting really is with children. It is really surprising to us how little our children know about where food comes from, and frankly, what they, because of what their parents think about food, think is healthy food. So we have a program that we are teaching right now in public school and with CDC Franklin County Head Start that focuses on 3 to 7 year olds, and the whole point of it is to teach children about, you know, what whole, unprocessed, healthy food is, where it comes from, and how to prepare it, how to cook. So we're actually teaching little children how to prepare food, get their hands in it, see what it's like, and learn things like seasonality and so forth. It's really interesting because the first four – this is a 28-week program. I think it's very unique among programs like that, in that the first 14 weeks really do focus on giving kids a language to talk about food because they really lack that. But the second 14 weeks really focuses on food from around the world. So each week kids are preparing foods from a different country. So they're not only learning about the food itself, but they're learning things like geography, math, science, those kinds of things. And they're learning where, you know, how food is used around the world. So that's pretty exciting stuff.
How welcoming have the schools been? Because that's an obvious avenue for you.
Some have been more welcoming than others. I will say, in fairness to schools, they're challenged right now because
sure.
Achievement
and
test scores.
It's not on the achievement test, is it?
Exactly. And it's one that we are faced with. So what we have tried to do is always be sure that we're invited. You know, we never knock on the door and say, hey, we'd like to come in. It's typically parents, teachers, principals that are reaching out to us and say, hey, we've heard about what you do. We like it. Would you come and talk to us about it?
We're going to talk about more programs from Local Matters. If you want to learn more about Local Matters, go to local-matters.org. We'll put that on our website as well, which is wosu.org/allsides. We're going to have to take a quick break right now, but if you want to pop in and join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a couple of chefs, a restaurateur, a grocer, and a grower in the studio all at once. So give us a call or an email. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. You can support WOSU by bidding on unique culinary-themed packages online for our Chefs in the City special, like a dinner for two with Master Chef Rick Bayless, or a Columbus Neighborhoods German Village walking tour and dinner led by Columbus historian Ed Lentz. There are many items up for bid. Just visit wosu.org/chefs to view all 13 items and make your bid now. But hurry, bidding closes tonight, and these great items will sell this evening. WOSU.org/chefs. 64 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 83. Clear skies tonight and a low of 55 degrees. Some sunshine and a chance of rain tomorrow, maybe a thunderstorm for your Friday, and a high of 72. Sunny on Saturday and a high of 81. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Chit-chatting during the break, and we almost forget that we're on a show and I'm working. It happens a lot in my business. My guests are Chef Kent Rigsby of Rigsby's Kitchen and Michael Jones of Local Matters. He's also a proprietor of the Greener Grocer in the North Market. And Adam Welly, he's a farmer owner at the Wayward Sea Farm. Why do I want to say that? I think I just got back from vacation where I was out of the ocean. Wayward Seed Farm. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you haven't figured it out yet. We're talking about food, and we're talking about cuisine. And how locally grown food works best in a local cuisine. How do you define locally grown food in Central Ohio? What's our local cuisine here? Adam, what grows here?
Well, it's Ohio.
Yeah.
We're really blessed, and we get to have about everything, really. We don't have a lot of things that we can't grow. We're even trying to grow artichokes this year for the first time. So,
really?
Yeah. And I think we'll be successful at that. It might be a 5-day window when they're available.
I was going to say a short season there.
But I think what we are finding is that it's a great place to grow hot weather crops, the sweet corn, the tomatoes, the things that we grew up knowing and loving. But I think what we're seeing emerge now is a kind of balanced style of farming where roots and greens and alliums and herbs, all of those kind of foodstuffs come to the table.
How do you teach? Now, you have subscribers, mm-hmm. a subscriber business. Tell how that works.
We run a fairly large CSA program.
What do you mean by CSA?
CSA is a community-supported agriculture program where an individual or a family purchases a share of the farm, an upfront cost, and we deliver 25 shares or 25 boxes of fruits and vegetables to their family at various locations throughout the city during the growing season.
So that's one of those cases where sometimes people are getting a lot of something at one time. How do you help them use that productively?
Well, my customers the last 2 years will understand this. We had the eggplant year of 08 and we had the beet year of 09. And
I heard about the beet year.
The beet year. We had a tremendous year for root crops, and it was cool and wet, and we just had loads of beets. And so what you do is, yes, you inundate them a little bit because that is the beet year. But we do really try to provide recipes every week. We try to be creative. And what we're doing with developing a new website right now is creating a long-term database of recipes so people can get right onto the website and say, hey, what do I do with my extra beets this week?
One of the things that you can do with extra anything is canning. And a lot of people don't know how to do that. I finally had to learn how to do it because that was the only way I could get the relish I wanted that my husband's grandma used to make. There was only one way to do it, make it yourself and can it. How do you help people learn how to do stuff like that?
We did do a canning and preservation class at Hills Market, which is one of our CSA drop-off points in Worthington. And we had about 25 people there that we worked on just basic techniques, canning. And we also were looking towards just some basic freezing techniques that people need. Lots of times people aren't aware of how to just freeze fruit really effectively. So we're trying from the bottom up to get people to realize that, you know, eating locally, just because we have a kind of short growing season, 6-month growing season, you need to extend through canning or freezing to be a kind of 365-day food system. So,
you know, Kent, for a lot of people, the first time they really get the idea of eating locally and how wonderful it can be is in a restaurant. How do you help people learn about that from your point of view?
Well, it starts with our staff and with, you know, the passion that we have in the restaurant. The food is very precious to us, and we you know, nobody is more depressed or upset than me if somebody overcooks a piece of fish or a steak or something. And it's not just that the customer will be disappointed. It's just that we've ruined this magnificent natural resource. And so it's trying to impart to our staff our philosophy, my personal philosophy, about the uniqueness and specialness of these wonderful products that we're using. And I think that eventually it starts to filter out, and customers appreciate that as well.
Do you actually advertise on your menu that when something's locally produced?
We'll name farms or resources. It's sort of a troubling thing sometimes on the menu because it starts to sound like Disneyland or something. So it sort of has to be tempered in a certain way. But sometimes we're just absolutely proud and honored to name someplace where it comes from. So, and especially with the local farms that have cropped up around Central Ohio that are trying to market to us.
Yeah, what is the market like? How many farms are out there now doing this, Michael? Has it grown, or is it about?
It definitely has grown. I don't know that I can give you a specific number of farms that are producing and growing food and focusing on food right now. I'm sure it's well over 200 at a minimum. But I think the idea of this is the more people get interested in and start supporting local food, whether they find it on restaurants or they're looking for it in retail stores or whatever, you know, the number of people that then are interested in either becoming farmers and wanting to start growing food, or folks like Adam then who can expand the production of what they're already doing, you know, the opportunities just continue to, you know, to move in the right direction. So a part of what we're trying to do at Local Matters is just really encourage people to support local farmers on one side and learn, you know, really what the benefits of local food really can be. And there are a lot, you know, and one of the best ones we're talking about right here today is just flavor. I mean, things are just more delicious.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have a call now from Sonny. Sounds like Bonnie with an S. You want to talk about giant food auction and Morrill?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. I live in Morrill County. That's two counties north of Franklin, Delaware, then Morrill. And there's a very sizable Amish community up here. They all grow huge gardens, not just corn for their animals, but groceries, vegetables, and fruit, because they put away everything for the winter. They don't go to the store to buy a can of tomatoes. They can them during the season. And the thing is, there's an auction that goes on here during the summer and into the late fall called Owl Creek Auctions, and it's right up here on a county road. The farmers stream into this location 3 days a week at least. I think they're going to start Saturdays too, and there's just trains of horse-drawn wagons pulling up with huge amounts of tomatoes and potatoes and just all the vegetables you can think of. And it's auctioned at this site. First, they do the main auction where all the local the restaurants and grocery stores come and get what they need. And then individuals can, of course, buy baskets of this or that. There are also numerous stands where you don't see a stand. You just see a sign that says fresh vegetables. Mm-hmm. The individuals will sell you, you know, a cucumber or a beet, whatever you want, that kind of a thing. And it's really well organized, and it's just a terrific source. You know this food is locally grown because it comes by horse and wagon.
It must be if it comes by horse and wagon. Have you been buying local food for a long time?
Well, I actually have a space at the Worthington Farmers Market, and I grow for the market, but what I grow is what I want to eat here at home. So I grow most of our vegetables during the summer. I'm not so good at canning. I don't like it, and the fact you have to do it during the hottest part of the year.
Yeah.
But I do have a big freezer, and I freeze a lot, too. So I get very little this time of year right now. Of course, I have to rely on Kroger's. But I've already been eating spinach and other greens out of my winter gardens that I seeded over, and then they come up so early they're still covered with snow. But it's ready to go out and clip fresh greens for gardens every night. It's wonderful.
Well, thanks. Thanks for giving us a call, Sonny.
Check out the Owl Creek Auction. It's a pretty amazing thing.
All righty. Thank you. The Owl Creek Auction. What's that like?
Well, it's just a large marketplace where farmers, mostly I think Amish and Mennonite farmers, come to auction off their produce, again, I think 2 to 3 times a week. And they're expanding greatly. I know a lot of wholesale buyers and other farmers market people come from different regions of Ohio to come there and make purchases.
So you mean people at farmers markets aren't always the growers?
Yeah, that's definitely – people tend to supplement sometimes.
I will say, Michael, too, that you know, there are some of the local produce distributors here in central Ohio that go to the Owl Creek auction and purchase – some of that product and then make it available for resale to restaurants. And it's really interesting that they've been doing it for a long time and really didn't even bother to tell the restaurateurs in many cases that it was local, because up until about three or four years ago, there wasn't as much interest in getting a hold of local food as there is now. So there really wasn't much of a need to, you know, to really let people know. Now that there is, they're really starting to advertise the local things that they're, you know, that they're making available.
614-292-8513 if you want to join the conversation, or you can call or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. Adam, how did you get into this?
Well, kind of through the back door, so to speak. I went to work for Michael Cast at Curds and Whey. in the North Market. And I met a lot of chefs that way. And Kent would come in, Elena Schock from Elena's would come in, and we'd always have conversations about cheese specialty goods. But what we talked about a lot is just availability of products. And I eventually decided to start a small little one-acre operation to grow products just for restaurants. And things like specialty kales or specialty carrots, because it was hard for them to source some of those things. And it just kind of came out of that. But what I did find originally in the beginning was that we need to cultivate demand for those specialty products. And that's kind of where the CSA emerged and where a lot of our growth came, because we wanted to educate customers about, hey, there's 3 or 5 different types of kale you can get. And, you know, you can source it from a local farmer, but you can also get it through a local restaurant. So I think that's one of the foundations of the CSA program and where we began and where we're at now, which is, hey, what do I do with these mustards or what kind of food this is? Because we grow very specialty things. So,
you know, we were talking during a break a little while ago about Jamie.
Oliver.
Oliver, thank you. Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution Program, and I was wondering what you all think about that. I think, Kent, you mentioned that, or no, it was Adam mentioned there's a lot of focus on the epidemic of obesity in the United States, and that inspired Jamie a lot to do something about this. But what do you think about it, Michael Jones?
Well, I think what he's doing is raising awareness of an issue that's extremely important right now. And I will say that it's one of the reasons why I became interested in the work of Local Matters, or what has become part of the work of Local Matters, as it relates to children, because I think this is a real epidemic that's starting to happen with our kids. And in fact, to me, the wake-up call was, I remember reading a statistic once that the current generation of children are the first ever in our entire history whose life expectancy was going to be less than that of their parents. And I thought, this must be a misprint. You know, we live in the United States.
Crazy.
This can't happen.
Yeah.
So to me, that was staggering. And then you see things like, you know, 1 in 3 children, are expected to get diabetes in their lifetime. 1 in 2 if you're African-American or Hispanic. So, you know, I think there really is a need to shine the light on that issue and then really work backwards to see what is it that we need to do to start addressing this in a very systemic way.
What do you think, Kent? Because Jamie's a chef, and that's, you know, that's his background and in what he does.
I really think it's an exciting and bold thing, and I think he's exaggerating his persona a bit to really shake people up and get some awareness going. So I think it's very exciting, and it needs to be done.
Yeah, Michael?
I was just going to say that I remember one of the episodes where he was standing in a classroom with children and he was holding up various fruits and vegetables and they didn't know what they were. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people felt like that was staged. But I will say that our food education team that go into classrooms also found many of those same things among children. I mean, literally holding up an eggplant and saying, how many of you know what this is? And kids didn't know. Some things as simple as potatoes and tomatoes, all things that, you know, you would expect anybody to be able to identify with. And again, children just don't have that reference point anymore because, frankly, a lot of their parents don't have the reference point anymore.
And, of course, the irony of what we feed kids in our schools, that was down, I think, in West Virginia or Kentucky or something, mm-hmm. and they globbed it all onto a big tarp and showed them what one class of kids consumes in a week or something mm-hmm. like that. And we were shocked and appalled. And I said, hey, it's happening in our schools here, in our suburban community. This is not, you know, just about West Virginia and Kentucky. It's everywhere because it's cheaper, they say. That's what the teachers or the cooks were saying at that school that Jamie was working with, that it's cheaper.
Well, and schools are challenged. I mean, you know, they're involved in a very complex system of trying to feed children. And, you know, some of it is based on subsidies that they get for the number of children that they feed. So they're working on a very tight budget. And I think, you know, schools really gave up control of food when they turned to food service operators and said, you do it. So the food service operators really are the ones who are the most challenged in terms of how to feed children, how to do it, you know, in a financially responsible way, according to them, but also having to follow certain USDA guidelines for what they must have on the plate. And those are some interesting combinations sometimes.
614-292-8513. And Bruce, you're on the air. You want to talk about summer kitchens?
Yes. The lady that was on there before was saying she didn't can because it was always so hot mm-hmm. in the house. And I grew up in Northwest Ohio, and I remember my both different grandparents on both sides of the family, they both had separate, almost like a home with a basement and attic and several rooms, and they were called summer kitchens, where It was usually set up higher so you could get a breeze through it. But they did all their cooking and canning in there during the summer months when it was hot, so it wouldn't heat up their home. And then I also love Charleston, South Carolina, and it's sort of the same way when they built the homes, you know, 300 years ago, they always did separate kitchens, separate from the house, and it was for safety, but it was also for the cooking, you know, for so when they heat up the houses when it's a hot weather month. And I just don't know how many people know that a lot of farms do have summer kitchens. And basically that's it. I just thought it was a good comment.
Yeah, it's a nice recollection. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael, you're nodding a lot while he's saying that.
Well, I grew up on a farm with my grandparents, and my grandfather was a tobacco farmer, but they also raised all of their own food, and it was a pretty self-contained farm. And my grandmother fed probably 25 to 30 people a day for lunch because she fed everybody that was working in the fields. It was like a catered event every day. And the kitchen was separate from the house for that very reason, because it was very hot. In North Carolina in the summertime. So that was that place where all the cooking took place, and then you went back over into the house when you were done. So it's a nice memory.
It seems like a luxury today, though, doesn't it?
Yes.
To have something like that. Kent, your food is – your kitchen is still set up so that people can watch the folks cooking. They can see what you're doing.
Part of it. About half the kitchen now.
Yeah. How do you show people – why do you do that? So they can make sure it's being done right? Because who the heck knows how to cook like your folks, you know, the folks at Rigsby's Kitchen?
Well, it just seemed to me when we actually founded the restaurant that the kitchen should be part of the environment rather than sequestered back and behind closed doors and some secret thing going on. But it does present certain challenges with, you know, the way the staff looks and the way they act and communicate. I mean, still to this day, I still, you know, tell people to, you know, people can hear you. You need to, you know, talk under your breath a little bit, or, you know, sato. But, you know, it's still been exciting, and I think customers like it. And so I couldn't have it any other way. I can't imagine it another way.
Actually, it really goes to that idea of connecting people with their food, you know, and seeing it being done.
What is interesting, too, because some people – because. Like I said, we remodeled the restaurant 4 years ago, and the whole kitchen used to be in the dining room, and we removed half of it and built a new bar in place of the other half of the kitchen. So people sit at the bar now, and the kitchen that's exposed is the garmanger station and the pasta station, and people will sit there sometimes and just be fascinated and watch the cooks as they prepare certain dishes and things, and that's really cool to watch that.
You know, another thing, it seems kind of strange, I was just thinking about how we have these bigger and more elaborate kitchens, and they're beautiful, and everybody always says whenever you have a party, and it's true at my house, where I have a very small kitchen, mm-hmm. everyone always wants to congregate in the kitchen, and it's kind of strange because so much you were saying that society's become so separated from its food, yet we apparently feel this sort of instinctual or cultural need to be near the hearth where it's made.
And I really think that's one of the reasons why food, you know, is so powerful in our society, is it really is that thing that everybody does. So we all have that reference point, and it is that thing that we want to gather around. I think it really is one of the best ways to build community for a lot of reasons. And again, frankly, it's just fun, you know. And people, I think, still gather a lot in the kitchen. I'm not sure they prepare as much in the kitchen as they used to, and that it would be fun to see more and more people wanting to do that again.
Yeah, but then they couldn't all gather in the kitchen, because I actually cook for my parties, and it gets to be a pain when they're all kind of leaning against the counter, you know, chugging their beers and trying to get some work done. We have to take a quick break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about local food, how to prepare it, why to prepare it, with Chef Kent Rigsby of Rigsby's Kitchen, Michael Jones of Local Matters, and Adam Welly of Wayward Seed Farm. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Capital City Radio is the new HD radio service from WOSU. Hear music and news that goes beyond anything else in and around Columbus. Get a fresh perspective on the news with shows like The Takeaway, Here and Now, and The World. Explore a mix of old and new music from a variety of genres, and keep up with the local music scene. Listen to Capital City Radio on HD3 89.7 FM. or online at capitalcityradio.org.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about StoryCorps, a nationwide oral history project that records the extraordinary stories of everyday people. And we'll celebrate the wisdom and love between mothers and their children. That discussion begins at 11, right here on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from the law firm Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, offering legal services to Central Ohio since 1936. Isaac Brandt Ledman and Teeter, big enough to win, small enough to care. On the web at isaacbrandt.com.
Support WOSU by bidding on unique culinary theme packages online for our Chefs in the City special. You can bid on a cooking class in your home, eat local with 25 weeks of fresh produce from community-supported agriculture vegetable share, or have a tailgate party for 20 when the Buckeyes face the Miami Hurricanes. Just go to wosu.org/chefs to view all 13 items up for bid and to make your bid now. That's wosu.org/chefs. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about food, local food, why you should use it and why you should cook it and how you should cook it maybe. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Where are my emailers today? I don't know. We're talking about this topic today. It certainly isn't a new one to the show, but on April 22nd at 9 p.m., WOSU will air Chefs in the City. It's a culinary event that spotlights local celebrity chefs and restaurants in Central Ohio. And, of course, MasterChef Rick Bayless is going to be part of that program. The event is tonight. It'll be broadcast, though, on April 22nd. So I hope you can give that a look. The theme this year is local foods. It focuses on a growing commitment to sustainability. Let's take a call right now, 614-292-8513. Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, I have a secret for anybody that wants fresh tomatoes all winter long without canning.
Okay.
As a child of depression, my father worked in a bank, so they stayed open most of the time. But anyhow, my folks bought lots of jars and lids and rings. But if you can track down Burpee's long keeper tomatoes, I bought mine for our generation of kids off the internet. So you can find heirloom seeds, but you need to track down Burpee's long keepers. But instead of canning, which heats up the kitchen in August and September, all you have to do is lay them on newspapers under a table in the basement, and they're better than store tomatoes through April. And I think my wife made soup out of the ones who were left in May. But
wow.
Before the first frost, you go out and pick all the leftover tomatoes that are still on the vine that you haven't taken during the summer and just lay them on newspapers in the basement where they stay clean and dry. And the newspapers will catch drips from one or two that may split toward the end of the season.
Yeah.
But track down Burpee's long keeper tomatoes on the internet and start your own seeds right now, and you can have fresh tomatoes all winter.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Paul.
Good luck.
Thanks. Have you heard of those kind of things, those kind of long keepers, Adam?
I have not. I probably don't have good enough mice prevention.
I was going to say, there are issues for some of us.
But there's still time to track down some seeds. I'm sure I can hit the web and give it a whirl. I'm always about experimentation.
It's an interesting idea about how, you know, different kinds of foods and how they keep themselves and how they grow themselves. And, you know, the idea that you can plant something, you know, a cold weather crop and be digging it up just about now.
Well, and that notion, too, of a, you know, of a root cellar is something that, again, yeah. I remember my grandparents had. So, you know, there were things like the potatoes and the turnips and the, you know, the parsnips, rutabagas, things like that that would go into the cold storage or the, you know, into that unit for the wintertime, and we would, you know, we would eat that all year long.
You know, it's funny, the vegetables that people have never eaten too, like parsnips. It's kind of shocking sometimes. I know I don't eat beets because I never liked them, but I was offered them routinely at the table when I was growing up. It was very common. And you'll talk to people and they'll say they've never had a parsnip before. They don't even know what it is.
You have to come and have our beets, Anne, because we have a lot of converts.
I'm ready to break through the beet thing because my friend, you know, who was on the beet wagon with you, I think in 2009. Last year, the cool season. Yeah, she almost, I think I actually did try one, but I've blocked it out. But I know they can be very good roasted. You know how you have a kid thing? Mm-hmm. You know, you just get turned off by something as a child. And my kid is convinced he was force-fed apples in Montessori school when he was a very young child and now despises his apples. So what are you going to do? We have a bunch of emails. My emailers came through for me. Email from Mike. If a farmer wanted to grow food for local restaurants, which vegetable would be most in demand? Adam, I guess it's for you.
Organic sweet corn.
Organic sweet corn.
Organic sweet corn.
The white sweet corn?
If you could work on the method of growing really nice organic sweet corn. It's been something that's hard to do here because we have a lot of pest issues with the silkworms and stuff like that. But I think there's a definite market for really nice organic sweet corn. It's just going to take some time and some effort and some technique to get it going. But I'm sure there's tons of chefs out there that would really take nice organic sweet corn.
Yes, Kent, is that
– Absolutely. You know? And, you know, the sweet corn season is fabulous, and we use it as long as we can get it.
It's the best stuff there ever was, is Ohio sweet corn, I think.
You know, and it's one of those things, too, as we talk about trying to ramp up the local food production to a point where there's enough, you know, for institutional buying. And that's one of those things, corn, that I know children would be especially interested in eating. So, you know, the idea of creating a processing opportunity so you could grow lots of things like that, you know, in the summer season and process them, flash freeze them, for example, and then make them available all year round to children would be great.
More emails. One from Carol. I feel local meat is more difficult to track down than local vegetables. Is it easier to eat local if you are a vegetarian? Anyone want to jump in on
that?
Yeah,
I'd say yes. I'd say correct. But I think
the only local meat I ever find is at the farmer's market.
I mean, obviously there's some, you know, some of the local grocers are buying Ohio-based raised meats. But yeah. I would say yes, it's definitely easier to eat vegetarian. But I think people try to do too much too quickly. You know, maybe you need to start with local milk and local vegetables and then cultivate those relationships with a local meat producer and just not try to take on too much too quickly.
Yeah, Michael.
Well, I was going to say too. I know there are some farmers too that are starting to make meat CSAs available. So that's another alternative for finding some local sources for proteins like that. That farmers I think are getting more and more innovative in terms of how to get things into the marketplace. And so that may be another solution to look for.
And I would just have to say, as an omnivore, I think that we eat way too much meat protein, and we could probably do with a little bit less and certainly eat more vegetables, but balance it out. And I think then it's just not so critical about the local meat necessarily. It's the sustainable or healthy meat that's grown, and there's a lot of unhealthy meat that's raised and processed. And I think without buying necessarily a steak from Zanesville, you can still have a very healthy steak on the plate if you source it out.
614-292-8513. We have a call now from Ann. You're on the air. You want to talk about fresh fruit growing?
Yes. We have an awful lot of folks out there in the subdivision areas that are neglecting the chance to grow some of their own stuff. The European method of having fruit trees on a linear basis called espalier. You can get various kinds of pears, apples, peaches, so forth. I've had the best success with the Asian pears being very, very good bears. But my major problem is, of course, Jefferson Township does not allow permanent fences over 6 foot, and I'm forever whacking deer off the porch.
Not literally.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Literally. I've reached out the
Must
window
be good
and
fruit.
Attacked them because the idiots are feeding them and baiting them. And unfortunately, we've had 4 deer through windshields close to me. But even in a subdivision-type environment, I only have 1 acre, and I've got 9 pear trees. And since they're linear, they're They're essentially flat. They make great borders. The Europeans were very good at developing how to do stuff in a linear fashion as, like, borders. It's a lot nicer as a fence, and I can't understand why more subdivision people are growing ornamentals and all that kind of garbage.
Yeah, you know, you it makes me think because when we first moved into our house about 8 or 9 years ago on Worthington subdivision, there was this tree out in the back of it was very, very old, and we knew it was a flowering tree, but my husband said, we got to take it down. It's just too old, and we've left it up, and then about 3 years ago, I noticed that there's cherries on it, and so I just picked one of them off, and sure enough, it was a sour cooking cherry, and now I got about 3 or 4 pies out of it last year.
Probably Montmorency, but if folks don't want to have it so that they've got a lot of wasted fruit, the Europeans, when you do that linear stuff where essentially you make like a hedge, and then you put wires, and then you essentially, almost like it's a grapevine.
Okay.
And a lot of these things will keep. The Asian pears are nicer because you can pick them right off the tree and then you can keep them in the fridge for a bit or dry them. But it's a lot prettier fencing, and apple trees, even though you're supposed to take them out after 30 or 40 years, I've got some up in Michigan that date to from 39.
I would imagine mine at least goes back to 67 when the house was built.
And then also red robin and tumbler hybrids. You can, if you've got a south-facing window, you can grow that. And then there's midget cukes. But the thing about both of these is if you've got houseplants, watch out. Mosaic viruses will transfer from them to other houseplants.
Okay, so, Ann, how did you learn all this stuff?
USDA.
Okay.
I worked for it for 30 years.
Okay. I knew something. You had something up your sleeve. Well, good. Well, yeah.
And local meats, go to the surrounding counties. We do have folks. I thought I was seeing things when I was going on Main Street and licking. There were some emus in front of my car. They'd gotten through a fence. So you can find these meats out there. Go to North Market and chat with those guys there, and you'll find out. They are raising meats on the edges of the county.
Mm-hmm. All righty. Thanks for your call, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
I feel so much better about my cherry pies now. I brag about them to everybody in the neighborhood, and they're just like, whatever. But I think it's cool that you can go and get a fruit out of your backyard and then cook it up and something like a cherry.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's reminding me of the next great business idea that we've been talking about at Local Matters, which is our edible landscape business, which essentially is doing lawn care but helping people grow plant things and take care of things in their yard that they can actually eat. So it's kind of an appealing idea to think that people would want to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's right about the suburbs. I mean, those lawns are – why not grow a fruit tree while you're mm-hmm. growing all that grass? Dave, you're on the air. You have an idea about locally raised meat?
Yeah. I guess your previous caller just briefly mentioned it. I do all my meat shopping at the North Market. Both their poultry and their butcher there. Is all raised, I think, no more than 40 miles away. And then also another option that not a lot of people don't know about is the Meat Sciences Department on campus, which is basically the butcher school. They have a deli and butcher shop right on campus with meat that they raise right on campus property right here in Columbus.
Where is that?
I believe it's right down Fred Taylor. Actually, I think it turns to the 5, just south of Lane Avenue.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great idea. That's Ohio State University.
Yes, and their deli, they have flat meat cut sandwiches. I think it's like $3 for a great sub.
Gosh, I forgot to bring my lunch today. Thanks for the idea.
No problem.
Thanks for the call, Dave. 614-292-8513, or you can email us like our listener did at allsides@wosu.org. Our listener writes, when I was a little kid, street vendors still drove up and down residential streets in Chicago, calling out from their flatbed trucks. They sold locally grown fruits and vegetables. Recently, I asked a gentleman selling his produce on a street corner why he didn't sell his stuff in the market in downtown Columbus. He said that he couldn't afford the $1,000 permit necessary to set up shop in the downtown farmers market. I don't know how much it costs. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Adam, you don't sell there, do you?
No.
There's been a proliferation of farmers markets, though, haven't there? Michael, you're working on that.
There have been. I think it's one of the places where people can access food and local food in easiest fashion. And it's also, you know, farmers markets are great places for people to gather it's a nice spot in the community to see people coming together. But I'm not familiar with the high price there. That sounds a little higher than
I wanted
I
to be cautionary
with.
About that. I'm not sure it's what's it like, say, at the Worthington Farmers Market, Adam?
What in terms of
what it costs to?
It's not very much. I mean, vendors' fees are fairly low. I mean, lots of times they vary any between $10 and, say, $25 for a stand at the various markets. So there's a whole host of new markets that are starting this year. I want to mention there's going to be one on 15th and High at the Wexner Center. There's a new emerging market also mm-hmm. in Hilliard.
You're going to be working on that, aren't you?
Yes. Yep. And there's going to be a new one in Hilliard. And additionally, there's going to be a market opportunity on Tuesday afternoons at the Sharon Memorial Hall in Worthington. Mm-hmm. So slowly, we're starting to see a kind of green market system emerge in Columbus, where if you want to buy local food every day, you can go to a market and purchase it directly from a farmer, which is really exciting.
One of the places where there's traditionally been a dearth of these kinds of markets, though, is in the urban settings. Michael, you're working on that as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, speaking of a mobile market, one of the things that we did last summer from the Greener Grocer was actually to launch a project that we call the Veggie Van, because one of the things that we are concerned about at Local Matters is access for communities who don't have healthy food right there in the community. So one of the things we did is we took all that great local stuff that we were buying from farmers, loaded it up on the vans, and drove out into the communities that were in need, stopped and set up that mobile farm market. I will say that we had moderate success at best, because one of the things that we saw was people were challenged with resources. But the other one was something that we've talked about today already, which was there just was a lack of knowledge of what to do with it. So people would walk up, look at the great stuff that was, you know, just purchased that morning from the farm and say, wow, this looks great. Wish I knew what to do with it. Mm-hmm. See you later.
Right.
So I think there's challenges beyond just making the food available. I think that educational component is also key.
We're running out of time. I just want to say thanks to my guest, Chef Kent Rigsby of Rigsby's Kitchen. Thanks for being with us today, Kent.
It's my pleasure.
And also Michael Jones of Local Matters. Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And Adam Welly of Wayward Seed Farm. Thanks for joining us today and coming off the farm.
Thanks so much, Adam.
Appreciate that. Now, Adam is going to be at the Wexner Center for the Wayward Seed Farm and the Wexner Center for the Arts have joined forces to present the market at 15th and High. You can learn more about that. We'll have a link to that on WOSU.org/allsides, as well as a link to all of our guests today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.